Roland, Roland. From the darkness behind me, a very cold and very bony hand reached up and closed around my mouth. The hand squeezed, pulling my head back. I expected a blade on my throat. Instead, something long and cold and wet and twitching slid across my neck and down my shirt. I cranked the wheel and clawed at the hand. The truck skidded in the snow, jumped a curb, and smacked a newspaper machine with a crash of ruined metal and glass. With a jolt, the front tires blasted through a snowdrift and landed back on the street, wheels spinning, grabbing, then spinning again. The thing on my neck snaked across my collarbone and slid down my shirt, something with the texture of a slug or a leech, but long, its tail snaking up from my chest around my collarbone, a cool, twitching, itching weight on my skin. I screamed, I admit it. I blew through an intersection blinking yellow lights, I stomped around with my feet until I found the brake and went into a power slide, the rear of the truck trading places with the front.
No, no, keep driving, said a soft voice in my ear. She will not bite if you keep driving.
Fuck that idea like the fucking captain of the Thai fuck team fucking at the fucking tour de fuck. I stomped the brake and cranked the wheel. We skidded to a stop and I screamed again. A terrible, pinching pain pierced my breastbone. It was unreal, like my bones were sprouting razor blades. I screamed again and grabbed at the monster on my chest. A hand reached out and snatched my wrist with a quick, clean move.
Be calm, said the voice. Drive. Just drive. She will leave you alone if you drive.
I didn't even hear this, not really. I got my other hand into my pocket and clawed free the pistol. A pain ripped through my chest again, unimaginable, like being torn in half. It crippled me. All of my limbs stopped in protest. The hand reached up from the back seat and very slowly took the Smith. Once more, he said,
"Drive. Just drive."
The pain relented. Huge gasps of breath tore in and out of my lungs. I squeezed my eyes shut, opened them again, and eased my foot onto the accelerator. I tried to look down at the thing that had me, its tail sticking out of the neck of my shirt. It had inch-long stalks all along its back, each ending in what looked like a small black eye. Several of the stalks tickled my chin as it wormed its way around, the end of the creature resting over my shoulder, squirming gently back and forth on the leather of my jacket. I heard the figure behind me shift on the upholstery, as if it was sitting in the back seat. I drove into the night, desperately trying to remember where I was going. I felt a drop of some kind of liquid crawl down my belly. I tried to say something cool, wound up stammering something like, "Wanna you wanna weenie me?" The end kind of trailed off in a shrill, choking warble.
"Just be calm. You're doing fine. Now, tell me what you were doing before I made myself known."
Who the fuck are you?
My name is Robert North.
Congratulations. Now, who are you and what's this fucking thing you...
Please answer my question. Where were you going in such a hurry?
Home. Why? What's it to you? What's happening tonight? I reached up and adjusted the rearview mirror to see in the back seat. It was just a man. Thin, in his 30s. Brown hair, buggy eyes, and a beak-like nose. He looked sort of English, but no matching accent. He spoke robotically, with difficulty. It's the way some deaf people talk, not able to hear their own inflection. He was wearing a white, furry woman's hat, what looked like a blue Walmart vest with a little plastic toy sheriff's badge tacked to the breast. He nodded toward the rear of the vehicle, where the stereo speakers were.
"That man in your... whatever you call it, your communicator. Does he need help?"
"What?"
"He sounds wounded. Does he need your assistance?"
"You're not from around here, are you?"
"Why do you not respond to my questions directly?"
"That's just Fred Durst on the radio. He's not talking to us."
"Are you certain?" "It sounds as if he is crying out while someone is strangling him."
"I know. That sound is entertainment to many of us. It's called a song."
"I know songs, but I thought they rhymed."
I looked back again and saw the man was holding my gun by the barrel, studying it with detached curiosity.
He had never held a gun before. I said, "I'm turning off the radio, so we can hear each other. Look." I very gingerly reached out and clicked off the power button. "Okay. I'm driving home. I live there. Can you tell me who you are and where you're from, or even better, who sent you?"
"I'm from right here, so far as you know it. Who sent me means very little right now. Why are you traveling home with such urgency in these conditions is of great importance."
"Did I kill the girl?"
"I do not understand the question. My interest is only in you and your desperation not to answer my question. I assure you that your own safety depends on your honesty."
The thing on my chest began pulsing gently, making gulping twitches. Okay, this bullshit has got to end. I'm neither brave nor reckless, but this was simply pissing me off too much. "I'm going to reach out again," I said, "to make an adjustment to the heat in here, okay?" I very slowly and non-threateningly punched in the cigarette lighter. "Now," I said, "I'm going home to check something in my tool shed, the little building behind my home, where I store things, okay?" He stayed silent for several seconds. A quick glance in the rear view showed a very grave expression on a bony face bathed in shadow and flickers of passing streetlights. The look of a man who's going to have his dog put to sleep.
"Fascinating."
"What?" I glanced down at the lighter. The slug on my chest slowly curled its tail around, coming to rest along my neck and earlobe. It gave a little shiver. North stared off into the passing night and said,
"They harvest insects here, do they not, for their honey? Do the bees know that they make honey for you? Or do they work tirelessly because they think it is their own choice? Have you never noticed that, after hearing a new word for the first time in your life, you'll hear it again within 24 hours? Do you ever wonder why sometimes you'll see a single shoe lying along the road?" A single tear rolled down his cheek. It occurred to me that the man was batshit insane.
The lighter clicked. My heart leapt with anticipation, and I realized with disgust that the slug thing could feel the change. It twitched and fluttered as if it were feeding off the excitement, or the increased blood flow. I shifted my hands, the left on the wheel, the fingers on my right resting on the knob of the lighter. North didn't seem to notice me plotting my escape, but said,
"I am at a loss. I have been watching you for some time, but there are great gaps in my knowledge. You know, I observed a man who masturbated until he bled. Did he want to do that? And you, when you were alone, you—"
I yanked the lighter free, the coils orange with heat. I slammed on the brakes and cranked the wheel with my left hand. With my right, I jammed the lighter onto the lump on my shirt where I guessed the creature's head would be with a sharp hiss. The slug thing shrieked and thrashed wildly inside my shirt. The truck spun and tilted up on two tires for a sickening moment. The truck fell back down on four wheels with a thud. The lighter tumbled to the floor, a streak of orange in the darkness. A small yellow flame danced around a hole in my shirt where I had singed it with the lighter. I grabbed around for the slug thing, and for several terrible seconds, I felt its teeth brushing against my skin, jaws working, struggling to grab on. I wrestled it free, and suddenly I had it tight in my hands, slimy and writhing, slipping under my fingers. It had a little circle of tiny teeth, each curled and needle-sharp like fish hooks. There was a thin, straw-like appendage emerging from the center, about as long as my finger and whipping around, flecking little droplets of blood. I took one hand off it and opened the driver's side door. I flung the flopping thing out onto the snowy middle of the street. I spun around in my seat and saw Mr. North pawing around the floorboard, the gun nowhere to be seen. I threw a wild punch at his face. North flung himself back in an effort to dodge it and gave me a shot at the gun, laying half under the seat below me. I threw my torso back there, my feet kicking around at the windshield. In a scramble of elbows and hands, I grabbed the pistol and twisted my body around. I jammed the barrel under his chin. We sat like that for a long moment, both of us breathing puffs of steam as the icy wind poured in the open door.
I thought I could hear a soft thumping sound, our slug friend trying to deal with life in a world of ice. Okay, I breathed. Okay. Okay, this thing I've got pointed at you, you know what it does? He nodded, said,
I believe I have an idea. Yes.
And have you ever heard the old human saying, I want to shoot you so bad my dick's hard?
I have not, but I believe the context makes its meaning clear.
Shut up. Don't move. I crawled back into the front seat, keeping the sights on him until I dropped my legs out of the driver's side door and stood up into the wind. I looked around the street for the squirming monster. It had crawled all the way to the sidewalk. I crunched over toward the creature, lifted a boot, and stomped on it. I grunted random curses under my breath as I pounded the thing again and again, hammering with my boot heel. The slug exploded in a spray of brown and red. The red blood, I assumed with disgust, was mine. I kept stomping, little flecks of ice spraying with each impact, until the monster was a wet, twisted stain. I kicked the shredded remains into a sewer grate nearby, then stomped back toward the truck. Sweat freezing on my face, my nose running freely. My teeth were clenched, my hand squeezed on the gun so tight I could feel the pulse in my palm. From a few feet away, I could see that the back door of the truck was open now, and when I got there, I was not surprised to see that North was gone. I slammed his door. I got in. I drove home. I saw just one other vehicle while I was out, a snowplow. I passed a cop in a convenience store parking lot messing with the chains on his tires. He shot me a look as I passed, like I was insane for even leaving the driveway in this mess. I had to pull over once and go over my windshield with my ice scraper, the wipers unable to keep up with the storm. I pulled alongside the road by my house and left the engine running. I crossed the yard, the network of footprints now just soft craters under the new snow and ice. I clasped the toolshed key in my left hand.
You have an alibi. You were at work all day, right?
Sure, yeah, that's right.
But who knows when she actually went missing? It could have taken days for anyone to notice, even if it was last night.
I was in bed last night, 11 p.m.
Were you? Can you account for every minute you think you were asleep?
There's one period when you distinctly remember being a pirate, raiding a cruise ship full of naked women. Could you have been up and prowling and imprisoning a girl in your tool shed? No. No way.
Maybe you had her tied up out there all day and you came home and decided you finally had to get rid of your plaything, or put it out of its misery. So you came in and got your gun and...
I suddenly pictured the answering machine on the little table by my front door. John had called, the red light blinking. Slowly. Slowly.
The new message light blinks fast, like a strobe. The machine tonight was signaling a saved message, one already played.
No. I'd remember.
Would I?
I thought of last summer, a month after Lopez and I broke up. She showed up at a bar where John's band was playing. I had drunk, oh, probably 700 beers. I wound up back at her place, a rented house she shared with some other girl. The night was a lost blur. I remember sweat in my eyes, my own breath blowing back to me off her neck, damp sheets, and a fly. This fly that kept buzzing and landing on my back and my neck, tickling me, waking me up again and again through the night. The rest is lost. Days later, it gets back to me, through one of Jennifer's friends, that I had gone on a drunken, tear-filled rant about how hell was waiting for me, and there was nothing I could do to avoid it. I said it was bullshit, that Jen had made it up to make me look stupid. But had she? How would I know? Some memories bury themselves so, so deep. And just like that, flashes of memory came pulsing in, like forgotten fragments of a dream.
You do remember. You remember rushing into the house and digging out the big book from the nightstand. You yanked the gun free and plunged out into the cold.
With the key clasped in my hand, I crossed the yard, continued around the house. The trail of prints that led back there were gone now, the space between the houses a wind tunnel that seemed to burn my ears right off my head. The Andersons lived next door. They were in Florida. The next house over was vacant, a realtor's for sale sign buried under the snow in the front yard. A single gunshot carried by the wind? Who would call the cops? You wake up and you're not even sure you heard it. In the backyard now, dimly lit by a dusk-to-dawn light off my back door. Just enough light to see the pool of pink slush right in the middle of the snow. A metal wire tightened around my gut.
Did you actually feel sorry for yourself a few minutes ago, having to live your life in an institution or jail? That's an actual girl's actual blood, Dave. She was warm in her home and ready to curl up in bed, and next, she was wrestled away or knocked cold. What do you remember?
You remember the flare of light and the gun jumping in your hand, then digging around the snow for the brass casing and not finding it. Night blinded from the muzzle flash, ears ringing with the sound.
And just like that night with Jennifer. You knew it was the last thing you wanted to do, but still, you did it and you did it and did it. You never stopped, Dave.
I reached the door and tried to wedge the key into the frozen padlock, my fingers shaking. I dropped the key once, twice, then wrapped the frozen lock in my palm to warm it. Finally, I got the key in and twisted it and popped the lock free.
A burst of fire in the darkness, the sharp crack of a gunshot, night blindness, panic, frozen breaths, blue canvas.
I pulled open the door, scraping it along the frozen ground. The piano wire around my gut tightened again, and I thought I would have been sick had I eaten anything. I have this tarp, a blue one, one I always used to keep my firewood dry before I ran out of firewood. Right now, it was in a loose roll along the gravel floor of my tool shed, above another frosted stain of cranberry-colored slush. There was something wrapped in the canvas, something the size of a body, something I knew was a body, rolled up like a murder burrito, a gutted deer in the bed of a pickup. I could have confused this for a slain young deer, in fact, had there not been three pale fingers extending just over the edge of the canvas. I turned away, stepped outside, put my hands on my knees.
Breathe.
Slow, deep breaths. I stood upright, let the steam rise past my eyes, my soul making a run for it. Knees felt like jello. I lay back against the door frame of the shed, then felt it sliding against my back. My ass was cold suddenly, snow soaking in. I was surprised to see I was sitting, legs splayed out in front of me, no strength to stand.
You guys know my sister, who's back home at this moment, in that big old house. If one of you makes it out of this instead of me, I want you to look in on her. Make sure she's taken care of. She ain't never been on her own. I want you to promise me.
In the end, the people riding in the back of that beer truck couldn't protect her. They couldn't protect her from me. There was no question in my mind I had done it. I didn't want to do it, to be sure, but I had done it just the same. And the thought, the gargantuan thought that swallowed me the way the impossible idea of eternity will swallow me upon arrival in hell, was that nothing would ever, ever, ever be right again.
Christ! The weight of it! No shit, asshole, that's why you have to act. She's dead, you're not. Think! Do you know what they do to guys like you in jail?
The river isn't frozen over yet. Just take the body and dump it. Cut off the head and the hands and dump it. This isn't your fault. No, I wouldn't do that. I had a vision of friends and family, and she had to have family somewhere, living the rest of their lives not knowing what happened to Amy Sullivan. No, they deserve to know. They deserve to know I did it, and to see me strapped to a table with a needle in my arm. I made myself breathe. One step at a time, that was the only way to handle things after they spun out of control. Step one, breathe. Step two, stand up. Go inside the shed. Take a look. Make sure it's her.
Oh, hey, that's right. You might have a whole collection of corpses stacked around here.
Then go to Amy's place and tell John. Just tell him no bullshit. Then call Drake and show him the body. Tell him the truth. Tell him I blanked out and there she was. Let's face it, if I'm this dangerous, it's better that I be locked up, for everybody's safety. I climbed to my feet, put my hand on the door.
Okay, fine, just go in and unwrap her and face this thing. Just face what you did.
And closed it. I snapped the padlock shut, then trudged inside the house. Chapter 11. By the way, looking back, if I had gone in and seen what was in the tool shed, I would have put a bullet in my own skull 1 minute later. Chapter 12. Amy. I followed my own tire tracks as I made my way back through town. I kept the dome light on and threw nervous glances behind me every 4 seconds or so. At Amy's house, I found John hunched under the hood of his Cadillac. I walked past him, the horrible news coiled inside me like one of those chest bursters from Alien. I said, "Your battery dead?"
"I hope not."
I noticed a set of jumper cables coiled in the snow around his feet. Hooked around one elbow was a knotted string of what looked like Christmas tree lights.
"Christmas is coming late for that motherfucker, soon as I find it. You got my gloves?"
No.
"Okay. Can I have a brownie?"
He caught a glimpse of my face as I passed. He stood upright, alarmed.
"Dave, what's up? Did you change your shirt?"
"Put that stuff back. I think I got it figured out."
"What? You do?"
I stepped into the warm house, thinking this was going to be another of life's little awkward conversations. I absently rubbed the cold from my fingers. I heard John approach the door, and suddenly ideas hit me, quick and desperate, panicked wild fastballs of thought. I could tell them it was an accident.
"Yeah, you can make it work. You can march people up to testify about the time you severed an artery in your arm trying to carve a pumpkin. You can pull the emergency room records from the time Jennifer had to rush to get you a half cup of candle wax scraped off your scrotum. There was the hot glue gun incident. People would believe it, would see that you're not a murderer, but merely an incredible dumbass. You see, officer, I was driving past the house, and I observed through the window what appeared to be some kind of shaved baboon, apparently escaped from a nearby circus. The animal was clearly thin and malnourished, which I believe made it an even greater threat to the inhabitants of the home. Naturally, I produced a weapon and subdued the creature with a single gunshot. Now, interestingly, it was at this moment that my penis accidentally fell out, and I found myself,
crunk,
creunk,
above me, creaking floorboards. I stopped, held my breath, listened.
The wind?
Above me, a door clicked shut. I stepped quickly and softly toward the stairs, eyes on the darkened doorway at the top. I glanced back at John. The startled look on his face told me he hadn't invited any company over. I pulled the Smith from my coat and pointed it up the stairs.
"Come on down, fuckers. Come on down. Come see David on the worst day of his life, destined for forever in jail or worse, still with 14 bullets left to spend. Whatever you are, you picked the goddamn staircase on the wrong goddamn day. Come on down."
I heard another door open, then close. Are the most dangerous creatures the ones that use doors or the ones that don't? I eased myself up the stairs one at a time, softly. My feet hit the creaky wood floor of the hallway. Every door in the hall was closed, but one, the bedroom. The library seemed like the logical one to check first. I quietly cranked the brass knob until the door clicked free. Nothing but darkness. I tried the light, and it came right on. No jellyfish. I backed out, took a step, and tried the door on my right, the bathroom. No need for the light. I could see right away that the room was empty, and look at that. The fat bag was gone. Toward the bedroom now, the gun in front of me in both hands, arms rigid like the turret on a tank. The old sensations again, blood pumping past my ears, sparks flying in my brain, that cool sweat again. My clothes must have stank of it. Something moved in the shadows, a thin figure, almost as tall as a man. A gray torso, like a rhino. It saw me and froze. A trickle of sweat crawled down my forehead, landing as a burning speck in my left eye. Holy shit, it's a shaved baboon! Through the sights of the pistol, I saw a young, very thin and pale girl, draped in a gray University of Notre Dame sweatshirt that she wore like a dress. I said, "Oh, Amy, hey!" An avalanche of relief buried every thought in my mind. Amy took several steps backward. She was holding a toothbrush and was nervously rubbing the bristles with her thumb as she retreated toward her door. Her other arm ended in an empty sleeve.
"Hi," she said in a too loud squeak. "Can I, help you?"
"No, no, it's fine. We were just worried about..." I made a huge mistake. I reached out casually, I thought. It's hard to come off casual with a gun in your other hand, I guess, to take her arm. I had to see if it was her, if she was solid. I wrapped my fingers around a very solid and very real forearm, but then she pulled away, and when I went to catch the spot where her hand would be, I grabbed only air. She ducked back through the bedroom door and slammed it shut. I looked stupidly down at my empty fingers and realized two things. Amy Sullivan was alive, and she no longer had a left hand.
"Wait!
Hey, I said, screaming and pounding on the door while wielding a handgun, in exactly the way an armed rapist would. It's me.
Okay,
she said, as I heard something scoot across the floor and jolt the doorknob. She had braced the door with some piece of furniture, probably the chest of drawers.
No, it's fine. I'm not armed. I mean, I'm armed, but not in a bad way. We've been looking all over for you.
I'm here, she said in the artificial sweetener tones you'd use to soothe a rabid dog.
You can leave.
I stuffed the gun in my jacket pocket and leaned toward the door.
Hey, where have you been?
Nothing from inside. I could hear her talking faintly in there, like she was mumbling to herself. Poor kid. I wandered back to the stairs, one question answered with several dozen new ones replacing it. First off, who did I kill? John came up the steps saying, who was talking up here?
I found her. She was in the bedroom.
He glanced that way and said,
damn, you're good. So she was here the whole time, like folded up in a desk drawer?
I don't know, John, and I don't care. She wants us to leave.
You sure?
John, we have to talk. I turned him around and we stepped down into the living room, just in time to see red and blue lights pulsing across the bay window. We reached the front door just as Officer Drake pushed his way in.
What's the deal? Drake said, brushing snow off his shoulders. We got a 911 call from Amy, saying there was an armed man in the house.
Drake went upstairs to calm Amy down while John and I waited down at the dinner-style chrome and green table in her kitchen. John pulled out a small package of what looked like tobacco and asked,
you think she'd mind if I smoked in here?
John, I killed somebody. As the words hung in the air, I had a split second to wonder how many people have ever uttered them and still gone on to live happy lives. I said, there's a body in my tool shed.
Is it Jeff Wolflake? Does that mean the manager job is open?
No. A guy showed up. A guy, but maybe not a guy, on the way home. He put a thing on me like a slug or something and asked me a bunch of questions.
And you killed him?
No, he got away. I killed some other person, completely unrelated to that guy, apparently. I was just putting that out there.
Okay. So who is it?
Don't know.
I didn't check.
I remember doing it, though, sort of. I shot them with the Smith. There's a bullet missing and everything. I remember doing it, but I don't remember wanting to do it. John eyed me carefully. He looked away and pulled his hair back, then tied it with a rubber band. He pulled out a small box and shook out a rolling paper, then opened the tobacco. He said,
you think it was like the thing with Danny Wexler? The demon thing we ran into at the mall?
At the mall, he says, like we saw it folding pants at American Eagle.
I serve none but Korok. You know, he said, the way they could take hold of people, move them around like puppets, then you shot me.
You gonna bring that up again?
You think it was Jennifer you killed?
I hadn't thought of that. No, I mean, that was amicable, right? He didn't answer. I pulled out my cell phone and pulled Jennifer Lopez's number off my speed dial menu. One ring, then three, then six, eight. Finally,
hello.
I knew the voice, sleepy and drunk, sure, but hers. I broke the connection. She's there, I said.
Well, that's everybody you know.
But if it was that thing controlling me, it wouldn't be somebody I wanted dead. It would be somebody it wanted dead.
Holy shit, this is madness,
John said.
So it could happen again.
I opened my mouth to respond, then closed it. I actually hadn't thought of that either. John started laboriously sprinkling tobacco onto a cigarette paper. I said,
she may not want you to smoke that in here, John. Yeah, I gotta make them ahead of time anyway. I get the urge to smoke. I don't want to sit and mess with it. You get the tobacco too clumped in the middle and it doesn't stay lit. Rolling is a pain in the ass.
You know, I think you can buy them now where they're already made. He started rolling the thing, unrolled it, tried again. I lowered my voice and leaned in.
Hey, John, when I saw Amy, I think her hand was missing. Well, yeah, it's been like that for a long time. She was in an accident.
Oh, and she lives here alone?
Yeah, why?
There's nobody who, you know, comes by to take care of her? John studied me for a moment, then said,
well,
Dave, I think one of the neighbors comes by to put out food and water in a bowl for her. Let her out, you know.
What?
Nothing. We snapped into silence as Drake appeared in the doorway, Amy barely visible behind him. She squeezed around him, the girl now fully dressed in street clothes and even shoes. She wasn't going anywhere, not at this time of night and not in this weather. Must be her hosting outfit. She had chin-length copper hair that looked like she had cut herself. Something weird with her eyes, the wrong shade of green. On top of all that, she still didn't have a hand. As she came into the room, I averted my eyes from the handless arm that didn't swing quite right when she walked, and then realized it was becoming obvious that I was averting my eyes, so I looked at the scarred stump where her wrist ended. Then it became so obvious I was looking at it that she actually folded her arms, her wrist disappearing behind her shirt sleeve. She glanced past me and said, "Hi, John."
"What's up? This is Dave, the one you saw in your hallway. He's not a psychotic killer or anything." He lied.
"Oh, I know. We went to school together."
"Yes, Amy, let's reminisce about the Pine View Behavior Disorder Program. Remember that time they had to restrain schizo Bobby Valdez and one of the aides broke his arm? Ha, 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 ha." I said, "Hey, I'm sorry about the, you know, almost shooting you. We just have some questions and then we'll leave you alone." She looked at me with the too long stare of someone with no social skills or diminished mental capacity. Like John said, I knew she had been in an accident as a kid. Brain damage? Was that her thing? I thought about the pills on the nightstand. She held her gaze as she said, "It's okay." She waved a dismissive hand in the air and smiled.
"So are you guys with the police or what?"
"Damn, you're cheery. Does one of those pill bottles contain Vicodin, dear?"
"Oh, no. John knows Officer Drake here, and he just called us to help out. We're, sort of experts on..."
"Oh, I know," she said brightly. "I've read about you guys. There's this website I go to, like a news of the weird sort of thing. I think you guys are mentioned in every other article. The thing with Jim... when Jim... well, you know, I did a lot of reading. Do you want something to drink? I have, cranapple juice and..." She spun and opened the fridge. "And... water... and pickles?"
"No, thanks." She closed the refrigerator and took a chair at the table opposite John and me. Drake said, "She doesn't remember a thing. She lost about 20 hours, as far as I can tell."
I said to her, "What's the last thing you remember?"
"Brushing my teeth. I had the brush in my hand. I had gone downstairs to let Molly out so she could pee and roll around in the snow. She likes that. I came up and was putting toothpaste on the brush, and then... the light was off. All of a sudden. Just like that. The toothbrush was back on the shelf and the water was off and I don't remember anything in between. Then I heard somebody in the hall and it turned out it was you."
"And you were on your computer right before you went in?"
Hesitation. "Hiding something?"
"Yeah, I think so."
"Nothing strange happened?"
"When?"
"That night. The nights leading up to it."
"No,"
she said, studying my face as some bad liars do, always seeing if you're buying it. No practice, this girl.
"Are you sure?"
On cue, John stood up and moved toward the door, saying, "I'll be right back." I turned to Drake and said, "Well, no crime committed here, right?" He fixed me with a dismissive glance that told me he was the cop and that he'd leave when he damned well felt like it and not a moment sooner. Amy said,
"I'm okay. Really, just tired."
Drake and I stared that way long enough for him to establish that he would indeed leave, but that his dick was still well bigger than mine. He grabbed his hat off the counter and pulled it over his ears.
"Yeah, I gotta get back."
To Amy.
"But you tell me if something like this happens again, you got that?"
Emphasis on me.
"Yeah, thanks."
With the slam of a door and a puff of frigid air, he was gone. I experienced the unique awkward silence that comes from being alone in the room with someone for whom you once made up a humorous nickname behind their back. Sea cucumbers, you see, vomit up their guts to distract predators. And around the third time she threw up on somebody's desk, we... well, I think I mentioned that earlier. Anyway. She studied the scratched surface of the kitchen table and drummed her fingers. My eyes bounced around the room, from the calendar on the fridge, monkeys posed in Victorian costumes, to the stump, where her hand should be, to the sleeping dog on the floor, apparently indifferent to both its own resurrection and the return of its master,
to the package of plastic picnic cups on the counter, and finally back to Amy's missing hand. What the hell was taking John so long? Amy leaned forward and said,
"So, like, what's the creepiest thing you've ever seen?"
I thought, then said, "I was at Cracker Barrel the other night, and two tables over from me there's this group of four old women. They're all wearing big red hats. Red hats and purple coats. I keep glancing back at them, and they're all there, just drinking coffee. Not eating. So I get up to leave, right?"
"You are eating by yourself?"
"Yeah. So I get up to leave, right, and I pay. And on the way out the door, I see another table. And there's another group of women there in red hats. Purple jackets." Amy thought about this for a moment, then said,
"Weird."
She looked down at the table, then said in a low conspiratorial whisper,
"Have you ever heard of spontaneous combustion?"
"Yeah.
I have a friend, Dana, who was in the grocery store one day, and her arm, like, bursts into flame, just like that, just her arm. And she's screaming and waving her arm around and around, flame shooting everywhere. Finally, the cops showed up and arrested her."
"Arrested her? Why did—"
"Possession of an unlicensed firearm."
A great, heavy silence settled over the room. She looked down at the table again, a smile playing at her lips, looking extraordinarily pleased with herself. I said, "You know, in the Middle East, a woman can be flogged for telling a story like that." John burst in at that moment, carrying a plastic squeeze bottle that used to hold dishwashing liquid but now held a clear, thick substance that might have been mistaken for hair gel. Though if you did, you would likely never have the chance to mistake anything for hair gel again. I stood up, John next to me. Interrogation mode. "Okay," I began. "We know you knew something was going on. You knew something was coming, and you had your room wired up to catch it on camera." Long, long pause from Amy. Finally, she said,
"It's happened before."
"Missing time?" She nodded.
"At least half a dozen times that I know of.
I'm sure it's more.
Little things. Starting probably 2 weeks ago, but who knows? You know, I turn on bathwater, blink, and it's all over the floor, the tub overflowing in 2 seconds. Once I woke up in a different room. Another time I was suddenly in bed, my shirt turned around, backward. I had been up watching TV, and then a second later there I was, lying down."
John said,
"And you never see anything?"
"No."
I said, "What do you think it is, UFO?
"No, no, no. Sleepwalking, you know, blackouts. I thought something with the medication, maybe."
"I'm sick of your lies, scumbag,"
I said. "John?" He pulled a saucer from a strainer in the sink. He squirted some of the fluid from the bottle onto it, then found a spoon on the counter. He said to her,
"Imagine something, a physical object."
"Like what?"
"Anything."
She actually smiled, amused, ready to play along. She pushed her hair from her forehead, and I noticed that, tragically, her bangs were the exact length to fall right into her eyeballs. She squinted into an almost comical expression of concentration. The gel in the saucer began to bubble and rise, twisting and spilling upward like the wax in a lava lamp. At the top, it slowly spread outward, like a mushroom. After a moment, it held the shape of a tree, 6 inches tall, like one of those little crystal sculptures some old people keep on their shelves. Amy was impressed.
"How?"
"We have no idea," I said. "Somebody mailed it to me. Guy said he worked for an oil company, and they found the stuff stuck to the end of a drill bit that had been about 1,000 feet down. They thought it was lubrication or something, like they had a leak, until the stuff killed one of them." The tree was already beginning to melt and puddle back into a gel pool. John held the spoon just above it and said,
"Yeah, it's pretty impressive that it can do anything at all, considering it's just a big faggot."
The gel turned blood red. The shape shifted. Grew a hole in the center. Spikes emerged from the edges. Teeth.
"Oh, you don't like that, do you?" John taunted. "I've seen gel that could make shapes twice the size of you. If you're so special, why don't you go out and get a job, you puss?"
With a blur and a clink, half the spoon was gone. The gel creature had it in its jaws, bending it and crunching the metal shard like a dog on a bone. A chair clattered to the floor, and suddenly Amy was standing, arms wrapped around her abdomen.
"Just wait," John said. "It always calms down after a second."
The color of the thing faded from crimson to pink and back to clear again. It eventually settled into a puddle, a chunk of bent spoon waiting in the pool. I said, "We got a whole collection of weird shit like this at home. The stories you heard about us? They're mostly true. This is what we do. We have a talent for it. We have seen shit that would fuel your nightmares, so you need to understand, Amy, that there is nothing you can say that will make us think you're crazy. But we need to know everything if we're going to help you. Do you want our help? Because weird things are happening tonight. Big, weird, stupid things." She brushed her hair from her eyes, nodded, then said, "Okay. Talk to us." She said, "The basement." The door to the basement was hidden behind a shelf. Not a cool pull the book off the bookcase to make it swing open Batman's secret passage, but a regular old bookshelf that somebody had set in front of the slim door in the storage room to discourage strangers from going in. Strangers, or a thin girl without the upper body strength to move a bookcase. It took John and me both to scoot it aside, even without a lot of books on the shelves. Amy shoved open the door, then reached around in the darkness until she found a pull string for a dangling light bulb, the once white string now a greasy brown. Cobwebs, bare brick walls, a smell like a pile of wet dogs. I realized about halfway down the creaky stairs that we were letting the girl take point on our adventure into the dark basement and how utterly unheroic this was. I reached out and, with a small move of my body, did something that would change my life forever. I gently moved Amy aside and stepped down ahead of her, putting myself between her and the shadows. Cold down here. I saw little rectangles of white floating in the darkness to my left, ground-level windows buried under snowdrifts. Around a corner, I saw something long and jagged poking out of the darkness, like a tree branch. In the dim light, my imagination went wild, seeing razor-sharp claws on the end. I stepped around the corner, blinking to get some night vision back. In my adrenaline-charged state, I saw a monster, the arm ending in a squat body, covered with pointed plates like an alligator's back, tall legs like a grasshopper, jointed backward and sticking up in the air, giving the creature a W shape. The head had twin bundles of eyes, clustered like an insect, which wrapped around the back of a narrow skull. The mouth was long and equipped with mandibles that ended in points as sharp as hypodermic needles. I stared at the thing, blinking, thinking it would reveal itself to be, I don't know, a hot water heater or something. Then I realized the monster-shaped shadow was, surprisingly, a monster. Amy rounded the corner. I screamed, "Get back!" and threw out a hand to stop her, catching her right in the face. I had the gun in my hand, yanking it free and firing in one motion, the sound deafening in the basement. I was sure the shot was wild, as likely to hit my foot as the beast. The creature's shoulder exploded in a shower of yellow sparks. The extended arm flew off, tumbled to the ground, the jagged end aflame. I kicked the creature in the chest, knocking it to the floor. I picked up the severed arm and clubbed the beast with it over and over again, screaming at the top of my lungs over the thunk, thunk, thunk of the beast's own limbs smacking its crotch. After a moment, it became apparent that the monster was not fighting back. It lay there, its limbs splayed stiffly into midair, as if petrified. I gave it 7 or 8 more thumps with its arm, and then dropped the limb on the concrete floor with a thud. I sucked in huge breaths of dank, moldy air, trembling. John approached, looking down at the broken beast. He said, "It wasn't very agile, was it?"
"Guys!" Amy pushed past us. She squatted and picked up the monster, setting it on its feet again. "It's not real, you guys. It's a model. A prop. Jim made it."
She balanced the thing on its feet, then stumbled past some strewn cardboard boxes and found another switch. This one turned on a fluorescent shop light overhead. The creature was actually a lot more horrifying under the glaring lights. The other arm was curled at its side, with talons that looked like they could cut down trees. I could see my reflection in each of the 100 little bundled eyes, a kaleidoscope of my own very tired and pale face. I said, "Oh, I'm sorry about that." She turned to me, eyes bright, looking like that was just about the most entertaining thing she had seen all year. I looked the monster over. It was, at the very least, an astonishing work of creature art. John said, "Look at that, at the arm, and tendons and all that." I examined the broken arm on the floor, the wound ending in a frayed spray of torn bone and connective tissue. Big Jim had sculpted the inside of this thing. The musculature, tendons, bone, presumably organs as well. Impossible. "He was into that stuff," Amy said. "He had all those sci-fi magazines, and he used to have subscriptions to magazines about makeup and effects and all that stuff, always mixing big buckets of latex. He wanted to do that stuff when he grew up. This one took him 2 months. He would come down here after work and just stay. I wouldn't hear him until early the next morning, just hours and hours." She trailed off, the memories of her dead brother taking her mind elsewhere. It seemed like a bad time to mention that I thought it would take a 6-man crew from Industrial Light and Magic to make a prop like this, on a budget of $250,000. This was soy sauce craftsmanship. "Jim, you crazy fucker, I'm starting to think we could have been friends." "Come on," she said. "Over here." She went through a short doorway that John had to duck through, a corner of the basement that may have been a coal room decades ago. She knelt down and plugged in a yellow extension cord, bathing the room in a harsh glare of light. 2 halogen work lamps stood on thin metal stands, illuminating a small workspace including 2 folding metal tables and dozens of jars and tubes, dye and latex and plaster and every other thing. White 5-gallon buckets were piled high in one corner. Amy said, "He had boxes and boxes and boxes of sketches and notes. He used to write these science fiction stories, really bad ones. He wouldn't let me read them, but I'd sneak looks, and the hero would always wind up tied up and naked and at the mercy of these beautiful female alien princesses who would torture him. Jim, you know, he kind of went a long time without a girlfriend." She was kneeling over a stack of cardboard banker's boxes. She pulled the lid off one and brought up a series of sketch pads. "He was doing something bigger, a novel or a screenplay. I tell him that they wouldn't let him do his own props and write the movie both. He said James Cameron did his own designs and models for the robot in Terminator, though. You know that scene in The Matrix where they've got a shot of Keanu reaching out to an open door and you can sort of see the reflection of the camera crew in the doorknob? Jim saw that the first time he watched it. Just a total expert. He had all these plans, always talking about selling the house and moving and—" She shrugged, cutting off the words, I think, to keep tears spilling out with them. She handed me a bundle of 4 or 5 art pads. I flipped through them, saw sketches of joints and muscles and hands and claws and eyes. I flipped further and saw something that caught my eye. It was a group of men, walking with 3 beings that were not men. They were pure black, their limbs represented on the paper by heavy swaths of charcoal, drawn like they were men made of shadow. The men in the picture were in a small room at a doorway. One of the dark creatures was reaching out as if to open the door. I flipped more pages. I saw another sketch of a doorway. This one was familiar. I had seen it just an hour ago. It was the abandoned balcony door upstairs. I glanced back at the broken sculpture and said, "All this, that thing back there. Jim said it was for a story he was working on? He never talked about it, but I saw his notes. You know, after. He kept a journal with all that stuff, and I had to sort through everything." She wiped at her cheek with her sleeve, and I felt like an ass for asking. We didn't ask another question, but she said, "It was parallel universe stuff, typical sci-fi, alternate reality and all that. I think his story was about the people on an Earth, a parallel Earth, you know, that was real close to this one, and they were trying to build some kind of bridge between the two. Then they would, you know, invade." "And that creature back there," I asked, "how did that figure in?" She shrugged. John said solemnly, "I'm gonna guess that was the thing that tied him up so the naked alien women could interrogate him." Amy laughed, and I suddenly remembered why I keep John around. I glanced back again at the one-armed creature and said, "Let's get the hell out of here." I couldn't have known it at the time, right? That maybe all of our answers were there, in Jim's stuff? That maybe he had pieced the whole thing together? At that moment,
on that night, I just wanted out of there. The rotten smell of guilt hung over every thought, especially on the subject of Jim. So yeah, we clomped up the stairs and flipped out the lights. All of Jim's materials were thrown under a blanket of darkness, never to be seen by human eyes again. I never went back down there, from that day until the day we burned the house to the ground. Back upstairs, John asked Amy if she had ever seen a jellyfish-looking thing around the house, or a huge bag full of what looked like butcher trimmings. To my complete lack of surprise, she said she had not. She also said that she had never caught anything on the webcams, that they were set to click on at the sign of movement. "It's always just me rolling over," she said. "I move around a lot in bed because of my back and all that." "The other times you went missing," John thought to ask. "How long ago was it?" "It happened for sure Sunday night, then Tuesday night, then last night, you know."
"Every 48 hours, John observed, "as far as we know."
"But it's not usually as long. The most time I had lost up until now was about 6 hours from midnight until early morning. This is the first time I lost a whole day."
"Is it always around midnight?" I asked.
"Yeah, I guess." Amy declined our offer to help her stay and sift through the webcam photos from last night. I was desperate to see what would show up, but this was her bedroom, and I suppose she had a reasonable fear of two creepy males clicking through shots of her dressing and doing the things girls do alone in their bedrooms, lighting farts or whatever. She promised to look through them and let us know. I told her that I was pretty sure I had moved the photos to a folder buried in printer drivers. On accident. John volunteered to stay the night and stake the place out, but Amy recoiled at that idea and said the night was mostly over anyway. And so, feeling like men trying to work a jigsaw puzzle blindfolded and using only our butt cheeks to grip the pieces, we left. I came home to see 3:26 a.m. on my wall clock. I turned on every light in the place, checking every room for any damned thing at all. I finally collapsed into a chair, thinking there was no way in hell I was getting to sleep that night. Too much adrenaline. Too many nasty dreams waiting for me behind my eyelids. I fell asleep. The room came back into focus. How much time had passed? I tried to move my arms, found that I could not. Somebody here. Footsteps behind me. Tried to move again, limbs not responding. I've had this dream before. Just got to... Oh, shit. A thin face appeared, leaning down in front of me, huge nose. My friend, Robert North, from my Bronco. He asked, "Can you hear me?" I couldn't answer. I was paralyzed, a brain inside a statue. "Blink your eyes, blink if you can hear me." I blinked, not to answer him, but to see if I could blink. I could. "Is there a way to kill a man using only your eyelids?" He said, "Good." He walked out of view, then came back and extended his palm to me. On his palm, something was moving. He held it up to my face. A spider. Huge. A body the size of a chicken egg. Black legs with yellow stripes. It looked to have been bred for war. North offered it on the palm of his hand and said, "I want you to eat this." I was able to move my lips enough to say, "Fuck you." "I'm going to say some words. I need you to listen very carefully. Tractor. Moonlight. Violin. Clay. Thumbs." This went on for several minutes, North rattling off dozens of words, maybe over 100. He held the arachnid up, legs twitching. "Red. Sandstone. Trombone. Stain. Linger." And just like that, I was dying. I could feel a poison living in my body, shutting me down, rotting my guts, burning my veins. And there was only one cure, the thing in North's palm. Suddenly the spider was my salvation, the narrow, bright window out of this dark room. I gathered every ounce of strength and leaned forward with my head, my hands still numb and useless. And then I sucked the spider into my mouth with greedy lips. I chewed through the rigid, wiry legs and felt a hot, salty fluid burst into my mouth when I bit through the body. I quickly choked down the bitter bundle of legs and gristle and... I snapped awake and leapt out of my chair. alone. Still dark. The clock on the wall said 6:13 a.m. I ran a hand over my mouth, a lingering bitterness on my tongue. I whipped my head around, confirmed that I was alone. This was a dream, right? Eating a spider? What the hell did that symbolize? Look at the bright side. At least it's not a work day. My phone rang. I would like to pause for a moment to talk about my penis. My penis is like a toddler who is a perfectly normal size for his age, on a long road trip to what he thinks is Disney World. My penis is excited because he hasn't been to Disney World in a long, long time, but remembers a time when he used to go every day. So now the penis toddler is constantly fidgeting, whining, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet? How about now? Now? How about now?" And Disney World is nowhere in sight. Thus, one of the many awful things I can admit about myself is that the 2 years I spent with Jennifer live in my mind mostly as a series of frantic, breathy memories. Clawing hands, tugging off clothes, heartbeat thumping in my ears, fingernails digging down my back, salty tastes lingering in my mouth. It's biology. It's hormones. As time passes, I can recall fewer and fewer of our conversations, and I couldn't give you the details of our 5 most fun dates, though I have a fairly graphic vision of how each of them ended. If upon hearing this you pump your fist and wink knowingly, you can kiss my ass. She was a good friend to me. She put up with my bullshit, and at times not even I can put up with my bullshit. But all that is gone, and what is left is a big black hole where the sex used to be. The thing with Jen ended with a pregnancy scare. She had seen my world and didn't want to bring a baby into it. This led to some violent arguments during which I pointed out loudly and in sprays of spittle that if she got an abortion, the fucking unborn fucking fetus would likely fucking haunt us. I mean, literally haunt our home until the day we died and possibly beyond. It turned out that was the wrong thing to say. It also turned out the pregnancy was a false alarm, but I was spooked after that. Found myself backing off more and more, making excuses because, gosh, I gotta get up real early in the morning and it's gonna be a busy day with inventory and all that, and I'm just not in the mood right now, Jen. We slowly went hands off after that. Jen thinking this had something to do with me not loving her anymore, though the loving part of me and the penis part of me rarely speak to each other. She cried a lot. She slept a lot. We argued a lot. She left. So I had been off the sex wagon for 6 months as I stood there at the counter of Wally's Video, having dragged myself in for yet another unexpected shift on yet another frozen morning. It was going to be a bad day. The hormones come and go like the tide, and some days it's no big deal, and some days it's like being 15 again. The other night, a co-worker had insisted I take home a movie called Ghost World, which turned out not to be about ghosts at all, but was instead some kind of coming-of-age story about a girl who, I noticed, had a fabulous collection of very short dresses. All I remember from the plot is 2 hours of Thora Birch's bare thighs. But I digress. It had been my co-worker Tina on the phone this morning, asking if I could cover her morning because, gosh, even though the roads have been scraped clean, she hears there's supposed to be more snow today and she doesn't want to get trapped at work, and I'm just the nicest guy ever. She really, really owes me. Tina, by the way, is short and blonde and bouncy and full of cheerleader energy. So I got dressed and drove in, cruising on those few hours of fitful chair sleep. Tina is also engaged, by the way, with a kid. On days like this, Mr. Penis isn't big on logic. How about now? I folded up this morning's paper and dropped it in the trash can at my feet. I had scanned it for news of a missing person, a manhunt, anything of the sort. Nothing. The front page was a shot of kids playing in the snow. The person in my tool shed was apparently not noticed missing yet, or they were such a total asshole that the town had gotten together overnight and decided that it was better left unsolved. 3 hours passed without a single paying customer. I looked down at one point and noticed the newspaper had fallen onto the floor. The day before, we had put balloons up around the store for a promotion, and during cleanup, one of my co-workers had stuffed a balloon into the little trash can. Inflated. It literally filled the whole container, so that no more trash could be put in. This fascinated me for some reason. I heard the door open. Officer Drake sidled in the door the way cops do, still in uniform.
He sidled all the way across the floor and de-sidled near the counter. I found my hands clenching a nearby DVD case.
Tell me, Mr. Wong, you wouldn't have to know about a guy from a